Okay, we continue on with chapter 22, today looking at, first of all, the place of worship and then the time of worship. And so let's begin. I don't think we'll spend a lot of time in the place of worship. A few things to say about paragraph 6. They're important, but there's not a lot of things we need to go through here. But let's go ahead and get started by reading paragraph 6 of chapter 22. Neither prayer nor any other part of religious worship is now under the gospel tied unto or made more acceptable by any place in which it is performed or towards which it is directed, but God is to be worshipped everywhere in spirit and in truth, as in private families daily and in secret each one by himself, so more solemnly in public assemblies, which are not carelessly nor willfully to be neglected or forsaken, when God by his word or providence calleth thereunto. And so here just the assertion that there is no particular place whereby worship or prayer especially is made more powerful. Of course, this is in contrast with the Old Testament worship where there was a place. First of all, the tabernacle, later the temple. But even then, if you read through the gospel, or not the gospel, read through the New Testament, read through Paul's writings, you'll see at places where Paul recognized that even in the Old Testament, there's an assertion that God is not more present in one place than another. The Psalms emphasize this point. But the New Testament then makes this abundantly clear. God is not better worshipped in a temple, in a church, at home, etc. He is worshipped, he is everywhere, and his worship is not tied to any particular place. Now, this was at the time of the writing of the Confession. The Confession primarily has in mind the Roman Catholics, the Papists, who consecrate churches, who view the church as the more holy place to worship. And if you want to really be heard of God, you've got to get to the church and light a candle and go to confession and do it at that sacred place. Then God will hear you. And then there's others, and just more practical and superstitious aspects. We have many who, and even today, you'll probably find, if you haven't encountered it, or maybe you have this thought yourself, who believe that that prayers are more clearly heard at church. So if I really want, I got a serious prayer request, serious issue, if I really want God to hear it, I need to go to the church so that God will hear it, that he will listen and answer the prayer. But Scripture is very adamant that there is no place that is sanctified. The church building is nothing special. Now we'll talk in a moment about the church. The church as the body is important, but the church as the building is not. There's nothing holy about this building. It's also not tied to any particular direction. Now, what was the direction that you prayed to if you were in Israel? If you were a Jewish person, and really to this day, there is a direction.
Towards the temple.
And so that was, you can think about, you know, when the children of Israel in exile, think about Daniel bows down towards the temple and prays. It's a part of it, that location, the temple is the holy place to pray. You can't be there, so praying towards it. In Roman Catholic churches, the altar is always on the eastern end of the church, and you pray towards the altar on the eastern end of the church, and they're laid out with this in mind. And there's this idea of directional prayers. But again, our prayers are not in a direction earthly, they're in a direction heavenly. We pray towards heaven. And so that's the emphasis here. We don't have a direction we pray. God answers our prayers no matter where we are, what direction we're praying, or anything else. And when we're driving along the road at 80 miles an hour and the person cuts us off and we end up in the ditch, we do not have to make sure we get to church real quick and we're oriented in the right direction for God to answer that prayer of help. He answers prayer no matter what direction we are headed and no matter where we are going. So there is nothing tied to any particular place in for our worship. Now, conversely, we're to worship God at all times and all places. Now, we need to be careful, and our confession is careful as we go through this. On the one hand, we have this assertion, God is to be worshipped at all times and all places. Now, we have a lot of people who want to stop right there. Yes, God is to be worshipped at all times and all places, so therefore, I will go worship him in nature, I will go worship him here, go worship him there, I don't need the church, don't need the body of Christ, anything else like that. The point here is this assertion is that there is not a holy place or a holy time in the sense that God can only be worshipped at a specific time or place. But at the same time, in this, there are other times that we should actually pray. The first thing it emphasizes is that we need to have private family daily prayer and devotions. This is a proper and good thing to do. We also should have secretly by individual. Now, the idea of secretly here, again, is not the idea that I have to look both ways, make sure nobody's looking, slip into where nobody can see me, and act like nobody knows what I'm doing. That's not the point. The point is that these are private. They are secret here is the idea of private. It's not out in public. It is something I am doing between myself and God. And these are important aspects of our worship when we are daily with our families, daily by ourselves. And again, there's no place that's more important, no place that is particularly holy, particularly sanctified for this purpose, but we are to do it. But then it makes a statement, especially in public assemblies. Now, this is the one thing we need to keep in mind. This is the other side. There is nothing particularly special about this location, but there is something particularly special about this assembly. And when I say this assembly, I don't mean in contrast with other assemblies. But it is that God has called us particularly to worship together as an assembly of believers. Now, we are not tied to this location. Even our assembly has had three different locations in our 6 years of existence, and we'll probably have at least one or two more, maybe hopefully only one. But the point is this is not the only place we're ever going to worship. It's not the location, it is the assembly. We are called, though, to worship together, to come together as a body of believers assembled together to worship before the throne of God. And there is something special about that. It is not that God that is set in opposition to private family prayer or private devotions or worshiping God anywhere and everywhere we are, but rather that God has promised to meet with us specially here. As we come together, as we corporately come together and corporately in prayer, God has promised to be with us in corporate worship in a way He's not with us other times. Doesn't mean He's not with us at all other times, but there is a special blessing, a special working of God in His church, in His solemn assemblies. And as such, it is good for us and right for us to be there. So on the one hand, we want to emphasize there is no particular place of worship that is particularly holy, but we don't want to run with that in the direction that many do in our modern culture, and that is to reject the need to be part of the Church of Christ. We are both go together. We need to, it's not one or the other. It is to remember that on the one hand, we don't have holy buildings. At the same time, we still have holy assemblies. We still have a community of believers that come before the throne of God and that God meets with through His Word, through the sacraments, and hears our prayers in a unique way on these occasions. Okay, let's go ahead and pause there. Like I said, I don't have a lot to go through in this paragraph, but I wanted to spend a few minutes. Are there any questions or comments over the place of worship? Yes.
I noticed on a previous slide, when you're talking about the Roman Catholic view, when it came to East End and West End, it said West End is World End?
Yes, World End.
Can you explain that a little bit more, I guess?
As I understand things, and somebody who's got a background in Catholicism may have a little more understanding of this, but basically I think the doors are always on the West End, and you go in, and that's you're leaving the world, and the altar's on the East End, and you go to the East End. I don't understand all of the thought process behind it, other than that's my understanding of how their service set up. So you're leaving the world, going to the altar, praying towards the altar, things like that. Yes.
I don't want to sound like I'm contradicting you, but where did you hear that the Catholic Church
goes in that direction? That's been my understanding. I don't know. I've heard it in different places. And it may be more traditional, and it may be.
Mary in Phoenix.
Okay.
Big one there. Altars at the north, south.
Okay, and it may be the situation that was more common back then. Back then you more commonly had the cruciform churches. I don't think are as commonly built anymore, where the floor of the church is laid out like a cross, and I think some of that. That architecture is not as common anymore. Yeah. Yes. No, Arctica does not at all. That would be a church issue. You know, our focus would be that we encourage it with the understanding that, again, that the center of Christian life is not private and family. It's the assembly of the believers. That we should be having private and family worship, but not as the pinnacle. As I look around our modern world, I see a couple different groups, three different groups. The classical pietist mentality that affects much of broad evangelicalism makes the center of Christian worship private devotions, and that becomes the most important thing. The more modern family integrated movement tends to make family devotions the pinnacle, and then church is secondary to family worship. But the Reformed have always emphasized that the center is corporate worship. That then our private worship and our family worship are important. They're part of, again, you know, this is, I think the language here is identical to the Westminster. Is important. We should be involved in these things, but they're both subservient. They're both secondary to corporate worship. Yes?
I'm so about that.
Yeah.
I'm just remembering when we first got married, first generation Christians, trying to practice this stuff, and we kind of there was an element of kind of bumping around and effort and consistency and all of those, you know, fits and starts and failures and successes. And I was just wondering if somebody had given some brain cells to this already so that we could use that as a
Yeah, I think on the one hand, I don't think there's necessarily a right or a wrong way to do it. The fumbling around, the start and stop, the struggle, that's a common. I mean, I spent about as much time counseling fathers on that in the church years about anything as I have people coming to me. How do we get some consistency in our as a father myself, I have the same struggles. You know, it is a challenge. I don't know there's necessarily a right way. There's things that, you know, I will talk about, I think part of the problem we get caught up in this, and I often challenge people to be careful, is especially with the, I think one of the things you've been affected with the mentality that pervades much of the family integrated movement of making family worship the center. There is this idea that has to be this big event every day. You know, we spend an hour and, you know, we have a full sermon and all this kind of stuff. And what ends up happening is because all those of us that actually have lives and realize that didn't happen every day. And then there begins to be this sense of overwhelming, I can't do it. And then all of a sudden, I can't do the hour, I don't do anything. And so one of the things that I encourage fathers all the time is, you know, it's better to have 5 minutes than nothing. And an hour is not the most important thing. You know, just spend some time in the Word. Get with your family. Spend some time in prayer. Do what you can do. And that's the most important thing. So, you know, again, there's things we can encourage. You know, one of the things that, you know, it's good just, again, if we're looking at this as being, to an extent, subservient to the corporate worship, take the sermon of that week and go through it during the week with family and help reinforce that aspect of it. Again, I think we need to be careful about any, you know, hard and fast. Here's what has to be. The point is the general principle. We should be doing it. It's right and proper. But it's subservient. It's not the primary place where God meets with us. The primary place is the assembly of believers. Yes?
In regards to the public assemblies, mm-hmm. How does the modern home church movement come up under that? Because that tends to be very on the private side. Not
yeah.
Really.
Yeah. I mean, when people say home church, I always have to, you know, kind of back up what we mean by home church. If we're talking about a real church meeting in a home, then it's no different than anything else. There's nothing unique about the building.
Even if it's just like two or three families, they tend to be very, maybe...
Well, that's my point is if it's a real church meeting in a home. Mm-hmm. Now, much of the modern home church movement is we don't want a church. We don't want the the accountability. We don't want this. We don't want the assembly. Mm-hmm. We want to have two or three families get together and you know, without the benefit of a of officers and pastors and things like that, do our own thing. And I would say it's not a church. Mm-hmm. It's not a church. It's not the solemn assembly of the believers. It is a I mean, it does not, again, it's not the location, it's what we're trying to accomplish at the location. I mean, there's lots of real churches, solid churches, true churches that have started in homes. There are lots of solid churches that continue in homes because they are small. It's not about the amount of people. That's you know, the point, two or three gathered in my name. It's not about the size, but that two or three gathered in my name is set in the context of church discipline. It's not set in the context of just, you know, get people together and God's going to answer my prayer. The point there is that church is not dictated by size. Church is dictated by being a set apart assembly with officers and with membership and with things like that. So there's lots of churches that meet in homes, and there's nothing wrong with that. And I think we need to be careful that we don't criticize somebody just because their church is small and meeting in a home. At the same time, we should question those who meet in a home because they reject authority, but there's the word for the church, and my mind's blank at the moment. No, you're on the right path, but it's the organism versus
organization.
Yeah, the organized church. There's another word for it that I'm trying to think of. You get the idea. So on the idea that we have an organized church, and that's what we need to be careful. What's that?
Institutionalized,
that's part of it. It's another word in my mind's blank right now, but it's not important. You get the idea.
Okay.
The point is that when we have home church versus trying to have a true church. Yes?
It seems to me what I've read were a significant element or a key element in defining a church is having a disciplining doctrine.
Yeah. Church discipline. Yeah.
In terms of the church.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, if you go back, the Belgic Confession, actually in identifying the marks of the true church, was three things. The preaching of the word, proper administration of sacraments, and church discipline. And that's my point. The command of the New Testament to forsake not the assembling of yourselves together is set in the context of discipline. The two or three are gathered in my name, there I am in the midst. That's set in the context, that's Christ's statement, and right after his treatment on church discipline. And so that is, I mean, it's a mark that you should have. Now, the Baptists and the Presbyterians, when they wrote the Westminster and later the London Baptists, they avoided that language of true church. In chapter 26, and we'll get there eventually when it deals with the what identifies a church. It does not use true church, false church. It doesn't use that. Now, a lot of the people that wrote it were part of it. You know, we got Baptist forefathers to talk about true church, false church. There's Westminster divines that did. But in the confession itself, it didn't do what the Belgic did and said, here's three things, and you're either true church or you're false church. They went along, the statement in chapter 26 is that all churches are full of mixture and error. Some churches are so removed from truth they become synagogues of Satan. Now, but in that bigger category, a bigger section of the chapter, it talks about discipline. It talks about the sacraments and preaching and all these things as being part of that. And so, yes, they all go together. They're all part of that larger picture, and they're all important. And again, that's part of the, you know, not just home churches. We have just a lot of churches today or things that purport to churches that don't exercise discipline.
Well, fellowship-centered churches,
yeah.
Technically they're not.
Yeah.
Calvary's a good example.
Yeah, and they reject church discipline, reject any kind of membership. And as such, you know, I wouldn't say they're doing what they're called to do as churches. And so that's, I think that's the point. You know, we can have, again, size isn't the issue. We can have the same problems and have 5,000 people coming as we have when we have 3 people coming. The issue is not size. The issue is, are we striving to be a biblical church with officers and members and church discipline, properly administering the word, properly administering the sacraments? Or are we just, you know, we don't want anybody telling me what to do, so I'm going to go meet together and with 3 people that believe like I do and things like that. And that's where we get ourselves in trouble. And so, yes, we can have biblical home churches. I mean, again, and, you know, the home church movement starts with the idea of they go back and look at the New Testament and see people meeting in homes. Again, that's the point. There's nothing wrong with meeting in a home. Lots of churches have met in homes. Lots of churches continue to meet in homes. You know, we're in a unique situation in this country where it is very common for us not. But you get away from here, the people writing our confession, the very people that our Baptist fathers, most of them are meeting in homes. I mentioned last week that they didn't sing because they're all meeting in homes, and if they sang, their neighbors would hear them and report them to the police, and they would all be end up in jail, so they didn't even sing. They're meeting at homes, and so there's nothing wrong with meeting at homes, but what are we trying to do? Are we meeting at home because we reject the institutionalized church, or are we meeting at homes because we believe in it, and we just don't have enough people yet to do anything else? We can't afford anything larger, something like that. So, anything else? Yes?
China would be a case in point, and
yeah.
Apparently there's still Bible smuggling going on
in
different places.
Yeah. Yeah, China and in many places like that around the world, home churches are still, that's where most churches meet in homes because that's the only choice they have. And the final thing here is that we're not to be, this public assembly is not to be carelessly neglected, and we are to do it when God, by his word, providentially calls to us. And we'll think about that more as we get into the next paragraph. Let's go ahead and move forward. We've been a couple weeks in these last 2 paragraphs, maybe longer. We won't get through paragraph 7 today, but let's go ahead and get started and see what we get, and then maybe we'll be able to finish up with this chapter next week. But this brings us to arguably one of the most controversial topics in our entire confession in our world. It wasn't necessarily at the time that it was written in the Reformed world, although it was very controversial in England at the time. But let's go ahead and read chapter 7, the time of worship, or paragraph 7, chapter 22. As it is the law of nature that in general a proportion of time by God's appointment be set apart for the worship of God, so by his word in a positive, moral, and perpetual commandment binding all men in all ages, he hath particularly appointed 1 day in 7 for a Sabbath to be kept holy unto him, which from the beginning of the world to the resurrection of Christ was the last day of the week. From the resurrection of the Christ was changed unto the first day of the week, which is called the Lord's Day, and is to be continued to the end of the world as the Christian Sabbath, the observation of the last day of the week being abolished. Here we have a statement upon when the Lord is to be worshipped. Now, I want to give a little bit of background on the wording from the Westminster that later is incorporated here by the London Baptist, and contrast that for a moment with what has often been seen as the contrast between the English Puritan versus the Continental Reformed view of the Sabbath. If you start reading this in modern things, you'll constantly hear people, I take a continental view of the Sabbath. I take a continental view of the Lord's Day. And the idea is, when people say that the people, they have the idea that the people on the continent did not hold to a robust, perpetual nature of the Sabbath, and that therefore they were just going to go out. It was, this is a uniquely Presbyterian thing that later Baptists thought. They'll also bring up the fact that the 1644 London Baptist Confession of Faith did not have much up on this. And so, if you see a church that says that they're Reformed Baptists, but they hold the 1644 confession, not the 1689 confession, that's probably why. They don't want the language on the Sabbath, and they want to hold, they hold the 1644. The problem is, that's not a good understanding. If you read many of the Continental Reformers, including Calvin himself and others, their treatment of the priority of the Lord's Day, the priority of the Sabbath, is really not any different than what the Puritans would say on in England. The issue was is it wasn't controversial on the continent. Nobody was trying to do anything else on Sunday. And so they didn't spend a lot of time writing on it. They made some general notations, general comments, and that was good enough. Even when the Baptists came along, it really hadn't become that controversial. Although it was at the very beginning of the controversy, beginning when the Baptists wrote 1644. But there was an event that took place, or a series of events, in the middle 17th century that began to change the way the Puritans began to write about this. Not change their view. Their view remained, it was actually still the same as what had been taught on the continent. But their need to be more particular about it came to the forefront. The King of England started what he called the Day of Sports. And every Sunday, he would call for all of the able-bodied men in England to get together and play sports on Sunday with the idea that they were training for the army. It was his day of training the army. Required all of the able-bodied men, whatever they were did during the week, stop doing that and come and work for the king on Sunday, playing these sports in order to do that. Much of the language here in this passage, to my understanding, reflects directly the day of sports. It is the exact same things that was used the day of sports. Now, why is this significant for the change? Well, the Puritans, and I believe rightfully so, said, you're the king, you've got 6 days to train your army. The seventh day is the Lord's. And they put their foot down and said, we are not going to participate in the day of sports. This is not the day to train the army. This is the day to worship the Lord. And so they begin to make much writing on this in an attempt to contradict what the king was doing. And then later on, when our Baptist forefathers wrote the London Confession, taking that same language, they kept the same language, continuing to emphasize the point that this is not the day for the king to have his day of sports. It is the day of the Lord and for worship of him. Now, the first thing that I want to point out with that is just simply that. There is no difference between, in general, you can probably find some nuanced differences from person to person like you can on anything, even among the Puritans, on the Lord's Day. But there is not this hard contrast between the continental view of the Sabbath and an English view of the Sabbath. They both believed the Sunday was the Lord's Day. It was his day to worship, to put aside our worldly affairs, and to focus upon worshiping the Lord. That was not a controversial issue. The difference was is it had become controversial amongst the Anglicans, and particularly the king in England, and so the Puritans are both in our Paedo-Baptist forefathers and our Baptist forefathers begin to emphasize the point in opposition to the king. Now, secondly, and I think this will be more important when we get into the next week and we get into chapter or paragraph 8, there are aspects of the language that is used here that are focused not abstractly, but very particularly. They're focused upon the day of sports, not necessarily upon any and every activity that we might be involved in. But I don't want to get to there yet. We'll think about that more next week when we get to paragraph 8. But I want to begin by giving why the emphasis upon this. The emphasis is upon this because in the mid-17th century, this was a very, very controversial issue in England. And so the Puritans dug in, doubled down, so to speak, and made the point of what they believed. Not in contradiction with those that came before, but just making sure everybody knew that this is what they all believed and this is where they all stood. Now, if we flash forward a ways, the Puritan influence upon the founding of this nation was very, very stark. The early settlers, many of them were, if not most of them, were Puritans, although we need to be careful that we don't act as if all of the early settlers were Christians and Puritans. In fact, many, if not the majority, were not. But the influence by the Puritans was very, very heavy. So that in Puritan New England, there was a strict observance of the Lord's Day, down to people walking the streets, deacons making sure everybody was observing the Sabbath in the town, and things like that. As a result, as we move forward into the late 17th and into the 18th and 19th century in this country, there was a very strict observance. Even though for the most part, the nation never has been a majority Christian, although we have some people try to argue they were, really were not. The influence, the Puritan influence, was so heavy that really up into the early 20th century, there were still vast sections of the country in which you were not allowed to do much on Sunday. One of the funniest stories I've heard recently, and it's funny and sad at the same time, is involves the Dallas Cowboys. Jerry Jones, the owner of the Dallas Cowboys, had an article about him recently talking about his how he began, learned a lot of what he did about business. And it goes back to his dad as a grocery store owner in the town they lived in, I believe in Arkansas. You could not have a grocery store open on Sunday. And all the stores had shut down because it was the Lord's Day, shut down. They made one exception. That exception was if you were Seventh-day Adventist and treated Saturday as the Sabbath, then you could go ahead and have your store open on Sunday. So Jerry Jones's dad became Seventh-day Adventist. And then in that way, his grocery store was the only grocery store in the entire county open on Sunday, which meant then that everybody who wanted to go shopping on Sunday went to his grocery store, and he made a fortune. And the interviewer asked Jones, so how long did your dad remain Seventh-day Adventist? He said, probably until about the day after the blue law restrictions were lifted. It's kind of a humorous story, but that's where we were. Again, and this is in the 20th century. There were still many places where you could not go to a grocery store on Sunday. Now, Jerry Jones is significant in this because one of the main reasons for the change involves football. As we get into the little further into the 20th century, sports were already beginning to make some headway, but football was where it really began to come. When the NFL started moving forward, they decided to play all their games on Sunday. They were initially told, if you do it on Sunday, you won't make it, because people don't do stuff like that on Sunday. They go to church, they do all the other things, and they don't watch, they don't go. You're not going to get enough people. You'll get some people going, but you won't get enough people going to watch the football game on Sunday for it to work. All of you that have been born in the past 30 years, does that make any sense to you at all? Now, those of you that remember when the beginnings of the NFL can probably relate to that a little bit. But the reality is today, I've got a neighbor we invited into church, and he's telling us he's going to come to church, but he has to wait until after football season, because right now, football is the most important thing. And that is the reality for most of our world. And with that, now we have our entire world, or in this nation anyway, Sunday is the day to do whatever I want to do. And we have completely turned. In 100 years, we have gone from almost nobody doing anything on Sunday except for going to church and spending time with family and church people, to church being the afterthought, even for many Christians. As such, we're kind of getting ourselves back to the point where we were when this confession was written, and why we need to start emphasizing the importance of this day being set aside. Okay, so that's a bit of introduction. One more point of introduction, and I want us to think briefly about the structure of the confession at this point. If you'll notice, paragraph 7 is focused upon the theology of why this day is the Lord's. Paragraph 8 is focused upon how that plays out for our lives. Now, why is this important? How many of you, when you have heard somebody deal with the Sabbath, they have focused upon it the exact opposite way around? Here's all the things you should or shouldn't do, and here's why. Now, what's the problem with that? Well, the problem is we get things out of order, and I think our forefathers that framed the confession were very very intentional and very proper in what they did. The real issue is why. The real issue is not what. That is secondary. It's important, but if we start there, we create all kinds of problems, and we need to start with the why. Yes.
None of us obey the Sabbath.
No, we don't. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we need to start with the why, because that is that is at the heart of this. And so we need to get through, why is this the Lord's Day? Why is there, why do we continue to honor this day? What is unique about the first day of the week? Then, as we get into the what's, there's going to be some room for difference of opinion on the exact what's. We need to be careful as believers that we don't in how we treat others who might have a different view on exactly the what of the day. But we do, but we all should come to understanding of the why. This is the Lord's Day. It needs to be honored. It needs to be given to Him. And then we need to, as individuals, as families, and things like that, come to grips with the what of the day. But we need to start with the why. There's one final thing, if I can, and how I forgot to write this down, and it was one final thing of introduction that I wanted to give that's related to that. I think I'll go ahead and give an illustration that's been one of the most helpful to me in a lot of that aspect of it. Seminary I went to, Westminster Seminary, California, was very staunch upon the need to honor the Sabbath. All the faculty, to my knowledge, were held to the recognition of the perpetuity of the Lord's Day. But there's two particular professors that this was their hot button topics. And the one particular was our president, Bob Godfrey. And one of my favorite stories, though, happened while I was in class one day, and somebody asked Dr. Godfrey the question, going back to our discussion a moment ago, is it proper for Christians to watch football on Sunday? Dr. Godfrey immediately went into a diatribe on the evils of watching football on Sunday. Made sure this young man knew that if he even thought about watching football on Sunday, he was evil, wicked, needed to repent, get right with God, maybe need to get saved. Because obviously he wasn't right with God if he was even thinking about that. Then he paused. Baseball, on the other hand. Now, what was his point? I think he had two points, and I think they're very important as we think through this. One of the things that, as much as strong as Dr. Godfrey was on it and my other professors, one of the things I hardly ever heard them answer a "can I do this on Sunday" question. Their emphasis was upon the why. Understand the reasoning for the day, and a lot of the what's will take care of themselves. When we start with the what's, what happens? What is our normal reaction when somebody starts with "you shouldn't do that"?
Rebel.
Why not? So we need to start with the why. Now, the second reasoning for that, and I think this is the point, Dr. Godfrey was a diehard baseball fan, didn't really care much about football. And his point is this: what is our default attitude? If I don't have interest in it, then it's wrong to do. If I like it, I will figure out some way why it's acceptable to do. Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's the point. We tend to justify that which we enjoy doing, while at the same time being critical of those who do the things that we have no interest in doing. And again, that's why we need to get away from leading with what. Now, that's an important question. We need to ask the question what. But we need to start with why. We need to start with why is this the Lord's Day? Why is the Sabbath a perpetual command? And I think at this point we're going to go ahead and stop for the morning, and we'll dive into chapter or paragraph 7 next week after giving this kind of introductory thing. We've got a few minutes left for questions or comments before we close.
I know there's a fairly modern movement, especially amongst people my age, with the way college and work together fills up a week.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people are turning to more of like a floating Sabbath, and they'll observe the Sabbath but on like a Wednesday or a Friday. And I have my own reasonings for why I don't think that's right, but
yeah.
I'm curious what your thoughts are.
That'll be answered next week. Okay. That'll be answered. When we get into the paragraph, that question will be answered. So let's hold off on that. And because that is an important question to ask, but it'll be dealt with as we go through the paragraph.
Pastor?
Yes.
Question on, you said Godfrey was negative and yet hypocritical, but would he object to somebody watching a DVR recorded? In other words, the main purpose is not is to get to the assembly to your church.
Yeah.
What's the issue watching it afterwards? And again, there are some that don't even believe in going out with friends or church members to a restaurant after church.
Let me say two things. One, I don't believe Godfrey was being hypocritical. His point was to show how hypocritical we often are. I don't think he would watch baseball on Sunday. I don't think that wasn't his point. His point was that he watches baseball but thinks everybody else is going to hell if they watch football. His point was that we tend to be hypocritical, though, with it. Secondly, again, the point is that he wouldn't even answer that question, is because... And that's what we want to get. We don't want to go there right now. We want to start with the why. Let's don't get into the what's. Let's get to the why. And that's I think one of the biggest problems we have. We immediately start asking those kind of questions, and we miss the main point. So we'll deal with some of that stuff when we get to chapter 8. Although I still probably won't answer many of those questions about what you should or shouldn't do. We're going to put in some general principles. A lot of those details need to be asked individually, but we can't answer those questions until we first deal with the why. And so we want to hold off on doing that. Yes?
Well, the best positive illustrations of that to me was in the life of Derek Little, the Olympic runner from the 1924 Olympics, who refused to run in the Olympics on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
But later on, when he was captured by the Chinese and in a concentration camp, he organized games for kids in the concentration camp on Sunday, because it was because it helped relieve some of the pressure and so on and so forth. So he personally understood the law, but we did not make it a legalistic issue.
Yeah, and we'll think about some of that when we get to the end of paragraph 8 and the acts of mercy and necessity, and think about some of those things. Anything else? One last thing, just one I remember what I was going to say is part of the reason we need to be careful with this is when we get out of joint on this order, we either become the what's become oppressive, or we throw off the why's completely, and that's why again we need to get this balance.